You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
Mr. President, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said that Iraq wanted U.S. troops withdrawn sooner, but that you negotiated to keep them in Iraq longer to help John McCain.
Yes, so?
So, after all your talk about conditions on the ground, you're keeping a war going in order to win an election? What about all the people who died?
Silly reporter, wouldn't all of my years of presidenting make you think I care about who dies? Hell, I'm surprised you can still be surprised.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome again to another edition of this fully non-corporate, fully independent indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. If you want to understand why this indie media radio show is so important, one only needs to look at corporate-dominated media to understand why. 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio is controlled by mega-corporations that only care about their bottom line. That's why all hate AM radio talk shows are so prevalent in this society. They make a lot of profit for their corporate owners, mostly pandering to the lowest common denominator. Take our big AM talk radio station here in Wausau as an example. It is a typical Fox News type station with your normal haters on throughout the day, including a morning show which is nothing but a big right-wing propaganda machine. Last week our local station brought on a, quote, election expert to talk about race and the elections. Here's how they introduced this expert on the show, the right-wing local show AM 55 Feedback on WSAU.
Joining us to talk about race relations is Jared Taylor. He is president of the New Century Foundation and the author of Paved with Good Intentions, The Failure of Race Relations in Contemporary America.
Gosh, seems innocent enough. Now, if you're a listener, you might start off with being a little suspicious about his guest, knowing that all the previous interviews and guests to his show would have some kind of expert with a right-wing slant, to say the least. And if you're a listener to this specific show, it is obvious that they cater to right-wing zealots in our community and give only, at best, token voices to anything center or left. Ironically, Mr. Snyder, the host of AM 55 Talkback, often rails about this and that, and one of his biggest gripes is the obfuscation and not telling the whole story by he and what Rush Limbaugh call the drive-by media, something Mr. Snyder claims he never does. Well, perhaps one would understand some of Mr. Tyler's, the expert commenting on his show this week, if the listeners would be told that according to the Anti-Defamation League, Mr. Schneider's guest is a white supremacist. Schneider's guest was quoted as saying, quote, some important traits, intelligence, law-abidingness, sexual restraint, academic performance, resistance to disease, whites can be considered superior to blacks, unquote. Apparently in past interviews, in a typical white supremacy ideology, he also thinks the races should be segregated. Now, wouldn't you think Mr. Schneider should let his audience know about this before he brings an expert on race relationships, that the race relationship expert about the election coming up is a white supremacist? A little bit of a detail I'd be interested to know about, I think. But nope, don't need to know that information. An anti-defamation organization got a hold of the fact that this local station was hosting a white supremacist on its airways and asked the station to screen them a little bit better in the future. The operation manager of the station and co-host of Schneider's program posted on his blog, quote, are Mr. Tyler's views so controversial that he should be denied access to the airways? That, of course, is not the point. How about mentioning the fact that this expert tours with David Duke and other racist apologists? How about not obfuscating the fact that he's a white supremacist? And if his views are not that controversial in a station manager's eyes, why hide the fact that he's a white supremacist from the listeners? If WSAU wants to host and give unchallenged time to white supremacists, that's their concern. if they want their advertisers to be associated with the white supremacist ideology, if that's going to make them more money, well, I guess it's a free country. But how about following what Mr. Schneider claims upsets him with the drive-by media and tell the truth, the whole story, about his guests? I'm going to play only a couple short pieces here of the interview. One can clearly hear his bias when you understand this expert's racist views.
Let me ask you this. You know, last week, Jared, there was a story saying that one-third of the Democrats would not vote for Barack Obama because he was black. Now, first of all, why do they put a story like that in there to plant the seed that this is going to happen?
Well, I think there are two purposes to it. A story like that is implicitly very pro-Obama. You want to shame white people into saying, well, oh, no, I'm not going to be like that. I will not let racism sway my vote. And so that's part of the idea. Is the number of whites who are so relieved to find themselves faced with a black candidate who is not at all like Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton, that almost out of pure gratitude they'll vote for him because he's black. There is a very huge pressure. There's an enormous pressure on whites not to be seen as a racist and not to think of themselves as racist. You know, don't forget, David Duke, when he ran for, I believe, his first statewide campaign in Louisiana, was for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was lambasted by every possible newspaper or public figure. There was no endorsement of him by anybody. He still got a majority of the white vote. That's quite an astonishing thing when you think about it.
Kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, he had a fairly moderate campaign. Basically, he was campaigning against racial preferences, and he was campaigning against mass immigration. I mean, he certainly wasn't campaigning on some sort of, we've got to hang them high or any kind of thing like that. But whether you consider it scary or not, if a guy like David Duke, with all the baggage he had, Klan background, and there are photographs of him with a Nazi armband on, if by coming out and saying, well, look, you know, I'm going to stop racial preferences for white people, I mean for non-whites, and we're going to stop immigration. I mean, those are two things that white people overwhelmingly tell a pollster they're in favor of. They don't like racial preferences, and they don't want mass immigration. He got the majority of the white vote. So I think if the Republicans, if they took positions of that kind, I think they'd probably do better in the election.
Ah, surprise, a David Duke apologist. I could bring you more, but I'm tired of hearing his vile. So let's get into this week's show. As always, we'll be starting out this week with a news and review segment from the folks at Eat the State. In this hour, we'll also bring you This Week in Radical History. Reminder that sometime between now and the end of the second hour will feature Media Minutes, Women's E! News, Peak Oil Check-In, Black Agenda Radio, Radio Spin, and Ask Mr. Green, to name a few, with some goofiness here and there as well. That's a type of non-corporate alternative voices from around the country and the world you get each and every week here on The Mike Cannon Show. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening.
My friends, thanks to my leadership in suspending my campaign, we were able to get the bailout bill passed.
Senator, putting aside that you didn't actually suspend your campaign, you ran ads, you and your supporters were on television, putting that aside, it didn't pass. So if your leadership was responsible for it getting passed, is your lack of leadership why it failed?
I'm pretending to suspend my campaign again. Hey, Sarah, your debate's off.
Oh, thank God.
It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, as always.
You betcha.
All right, moving on to the economy.
We can ask, why did the bailout plan, we talked about that last week a little bit, and why it wasn't a good deal, and why did the bailout plan pass Congress when it failed in the House on Monday? Well, right after it failed, the leaders in the House, and particularly the leaders in the Senate, who had closed their doors to financial industry lobbyists before and had said that they would work out a deal on their own, they didn't need the industry to come in and try to tell them how to draft a plan to bail out that same industry. Well, on Monday, when the House version failed, when the initial version failed, the leaders in the Senate said, well, maybe it's time to open our doors, and they let the lobbyists in, and of course they got the kind of bill that you can expect when you have industry lobbyists from the financial industry and from business groups come in and say, this is what we want, add this, add this, add this. So the bill went from being initially 3 pages long, that was the version that the House voted on, to being 110 pages long and including so much pork that not even the news media could hide it. It was just an enormous number of tax breaks for all kinds of things. You could even turn on the TV news and hear a TV newscaster say that some of these tax breaks were laughably ridiculous. That's the bill that passed. And the reason it passed was because Senator Obama had called up the Democrats who had opposed it and said, pass this bill and I will help you get things like a bill to allow bankruptcy court judges to consider people's mortgages when they go through through bankruptcy court in addition to their other loans. That was something the Democrats had pushed for, but the Republicans had nixed from the bill originally. Obama promised that he would bring that up for Democrats to consider if and when he becomes president. And so that won over a bunch of Democrats, and of course the Republicans voted for the bill because of all of the pork that was included, the tax cuts for business and for the financial industry and for wealthy Americans. But I think more importantly, a lot of congressmen and women caved and voted for the bailout plan because they believed the story of what the bailout plan would do, that it would unfreeze credit markets, that it would keep interest rates low, that it would increase confidence of investors, calm the panic among bank customers who are doing runs on banks currently, that it would prevent layoffs and it would stave off a recession. That's a pretty tall order. And this bailout plan is not likely to be able to do any of that. And I just want to talk about why.
Particularly because it's not designed to do any of that.
Yeah, I really want to talk about why. There are already indicators out there that the plan isn't going to work. For one thing, the Dow Jones plummeted immediately after the bill was passed. Late on Friday. And it's not as if the stock market moves very slowly. The stock market, in fact, can turn on a dime. And it did on Monday while the voting was going on in the House and it looked like the plan would not pass. The stock market had its largest fall in recent history. So the stock market can turn on a dime and register investors' confidence almost immediately. And it did. It registered investors' attitude that this bill is not enough, it is not going to help, it is not what we expected and what we hoped for.
So why did the stock market fall both after the plan failed on Monday and then again after a similar plan passed later in the week?
Well, for one thing, they had a chance to think about what the bailout plan would do. For another, the bailout plan includes all this additional spending that's going to drive up the federal deficit, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute here. Another thing that we're seeing, too, is that credit markets have tightened even further. So instead of helping loosen credit markets, the promise of additional cash helping to loosen credit markets has actually made them tighten even further. And we can ask, why did the credit markets tighten up immediately after the vote? Well, it's because banks need the cash on hand. They have to have the cash because their customers are in a panic, and they have to be able to pay when customers line up to take their money out of the banks. That's called a run on a bank. Banks need to cover the situation when that happens, and they need the cash on hand to do that. So they can't loan it out. They really can't. There's plenty of cash in the system if we say, well, okay, the way to solve this is to give banks more cash. Well, the Fed has been doing that, and it's been doing that to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, perhaps more than this actual bailout plan would consist of. So we're getting upwards of more than $700 billion already pumped into the system by the Fed through its discount window and extremely low interest rate loans to these banks on very, very favorable terms. And yet the cash isn't going anywhere. Banks are holding it because they need to have it in case of a bank run. So, of course, what has to be done is something to calm the panic and to tell investors and to tell bank customers that they don't have to go and take their money out of banks. One of the things that the bailout plan did do is that it increased FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, insurance on bank accounts from $100,000 to $250,000 to cover small businesses, essentially small to medium-sized businesses, which often keep larger amounts of cash in bank accounts in order to cover payroll and things like that. So that was one positive move in the bailout plan. You've got a question, Mike, don't you?
Yeah. So when they do that, they bumped it up from $100,000 to $250,000. Don't they have to have extra funds to be able to back that up?
Yeah, that would be helpful. And one of the reasons why the Dow fell, again, is looking at this bailout plan. They said, oh, my God, if these banks do turn to the FDIC, it means the federal government's going to have to pump billions more into the FDIC to cover runs on banks, et cetera. That's going to push up the deficit. That's going to, you know, increase interest rates. It's going to really have a negative impact on the economy. So, and at the same time, while the Fed has held the federal funds rate down to 2%, hoping that this would bring interest rates down so that more people could borrow and more people could buy homes. In fact, mortgage rates are actually creeping up. Interest on credit cards and consumer loans is up, and the LIBOR, the London Interbank Operating Rate, the rate at which banks loan money to each other, is continually creeping. It's continuing to creep upwards, and it's because, of course, as I said, banks need the cash on hand to cover bank runs. So
and the supply and demand. There's more demand for loans and for liquid money than there is supply.
No, I just said that there's plenty of cash there, but banks are hanging on to it.
Well, that's the supply that's available on the market, I mean.
Yeah, anyway, so there are signs that the recession is already here. There's record unemployment. There was record unemployment in September, and plunging consumer spending, which is the big issue, because we've talked in the past about how consumer spending drives about two-thirds of the economy. Well, right now people are in a panic. Not only are they pulling cash out of their bank accounts and stuffing it in the mattress or buying gold or whatever, which is a silly thing to do, but people are doing it. But people are also not buying anything. And that's really, I think, what's at the heart of the current economic jitters. It's not a tight credit market, per se, but the reason you're starting to see layoffs is because people are not buying anything at all. They're not buying things that they need, and they're not buying things that they can afford. For example, retailers are saying that you go to the mall these days and it's like a ghost town. There's almost no one there. Nobody's buying clothes for their kids. You know, people are saying we're just going to make do until we know what's going to happen. And of course, that's going to lead to layoffs down the line. So I think
it's the flip side of the truism that we've been hearing for years, which is that the world economy is being propped up by Americans' willingness to spend themselves into debt.
Exactly, exactly. So we've had, you know, this long era, these 10 years or so of easy credit, where you could walk into, for example, you could walk into an auto dealership and say, I want that model, where do I sign? You could get the car and you could get a loan that same day. We've had years and years of easy credit. And without any kind of background checks, without anybody paying attention to how much debt people are running up. So there's this bloat of debt in the system. And what America has become is not just people who have, individuals who have a lot of debt and can't pay it off, but also the country itself has a lot of debt that it's going to be struggling to pay off in the future. We have a record federal deficit and a record trade deficit. And what's really important now is not just the federal deficit, but also the trade deficit, which tells you what our role is in the global economy. The U.S.'s role in the global economy has been one of, we are the market of last resort. We will buy anything and everything that's out there, and we will borrow as much money as we need to in order to do that. And so we have this record trade deficit, and the countries that have the trade surplus are predominantly China, has a major trade surplus. Countries in Asia that are manufacturing countries, that, you know, we've bought their automobiles, we've bought their clothes, we've bought their consumer electronics, we've bought all these goods and stuff, and we've basically propped up the global economy by borrowing more money. So there's got to be a correction. That's going to happen no matter what kind of bailout plan passes Congress. America is in for either a quick, severe collapse, which is what the bailout plan was really designed to try to prevent, or a long and protracted contraction. So what I think is the most interesting is that the bailout plan may not even work to help avoid a quick severe collapse, which I find kind of interesting. What really is necessary to avoid that is to have some leadership at the federal level. For example, to have a president who actually does his job, who will go into a meeting to not do what he did this last weekend before the bailout plan.
You're referring
went
to Bush?
To Congress. Yeah, George Bush.
Okay, because I'm not sure everybody's clear that we do have a president at the moment.
Yeah. George Bush is very interesting. He went into the meeting on Sunday with congressional leaders. He had congressional leaders. He had Obama. He had McCain there. He had the Fed, the head of the Fed there. He had the Treasury Secretary there. All in the same room, they were going to sit down and hammer out a bailout plan that would do the work to prevent a severe, quick collapse of the financial industry. George Bush opened the meeting, and then he got up and said, "I got something else to do," and he left.
He had a golf date.
Yeah, he had a golf game or something. Who knows? He left. He didn't sit through the whole meeting. He came back at the end, and he said, "Okay, can we agree on something here?" And, of course, the answer was no. The members of his own party had staged a revolt and said, "We don't like this bailout plan. We're not for it." And they got up and walked out of the room. So this shows you the lack
worst
of leadership.
President ever.
Yeah, it shows you the lack of leadership at the federal level. And an economic situation like this, if you want to avoid a quick, severe shock, you have to have somebody, namely the president, stand up and say, "This is the problem. I understand the problem. This is the plan that we have to deal with the problem. This is how it's going to work. You need to worry about these things, but not these other things." And George Bush can't do that because he can't do the very first thing to be able to do that, which is say, "This is the problem, and I understand the problem," because he doesn't understand the problem. So I think the most important thing people can come away with this week is that this bailout plan was supposed to prevent a very quick and severe fall in markets and an economic collapse and make it into a long and protracted but not quite so severe one, so that people don't suffer immediately. And I think the bailout plans may not even do that job, you know?
So how long before the IMF imposes a structural adjustment program?
I don't know. But, you know, it's always risky to make predictions about the future when it comes to the economy, because anything can happen. I mean, you can have another Hurricane Katrina, or there could be another terrorist attack or something fantastic could fall out of the sky and save us at the last minute. You never know. It's risky to make predictions, but there are some things that we know for sure, and I just want to talk about those for a little bit. We know that house prices are too high, and we know why. We know that appraisers colluded with real estate agents to drive prices up. They didn't do fair appraisals, and this is true for all markets around the country. It's not just true for California, Nevada, and Florida. It's true even here in Seattle. We know that house prices are going to have to come down more until they become affordable again. So it's really easy for people to look at a way to know if house prices are going to fall more is look at the median income in your area and look at the average price for a 2 to 3 bedroom house and figure out, is it affordable yet? So we know that. We know that's going to happen. We know that that people who bought houses to live in with 30-year fixed mortgages were the minority in the last 5 years, but they're the people who are going to be okay, regardless of what house prices do. People who got anything else, they're the ones who are not going to be okay, and something is going to have to be done to help those people out. I don't know. It may not come from the federal level. It may have to be a lot of local government work, but something's going to have to be done to help people who are being kicked out on the street and houses that are going vacant and not getting sold. We know that the markets, the stock market, the credit market, etc., they're not going to settle down until after the election at the earliest. We know that for sure because this bailout plan is not doing it. We know depending on how the election turns out, we know that the markets are going to continue to be volatile. We know that. We know that regardless of who becomes president, taxes are going to go up across the board. I don't care what you know, Senator Obama says about middle-class tax cuts. I don't care what John McCain says about continuing to renew the tax cuts that George Bush put into place. It doesn't matter which of them gets elected. Taxes will have to go up because the federal government can't continue to run up the deficit. It's going to impact interest rates. It's going to drive the economy even further into recession. Either one of them, there are going to be tax increases. And the tax increases are going to happen to everyone, rich, poor, everyone. Doesn't matter whether it's John McCain or whether it's Barack Obama. That said, Barack Obama would be miles ahead of John McCain when it comes to dealing with the economy because Obama understands what's going on, and I don't think McCain does. We also know that it's going to be harder to borrow money. And that's not just going to be for the next month or 2 months or 3 months. It's or for the next year or 2 years or 3 years. It's going to be for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. It's just like after the Great Depression, banks are going to have to, and they're already starting to do this, they're going to have to ask for verification. They're going to check and double check and triple check your credit worthiness. You're going to have a down payment for a house. You're going to have paid off your prior auto loan before you get a new one. Credit is going to be harder to get. Money is going to be harder to borrow. We know that for sure. We also know that regulations for the financial industry are coming. We don't know for sure yet whether they're going to be good ones or bad ones or ones that make it easy for banks to go ahead and start doing some of the same things that got us into this mess in the first place. But we know they're coming. And I think, again, a lot depends on which person gets elected for president may help determine what kind of regulations are put into place. So those are a few things that we know for sure.
One of the questions that I had, somewhere between a question and a point, we saw a letter yesterday from Schwarzenegger in California saying that California may need to borrow $7 billion because, as with many states, they use short-term credit to help make up some of their operating expenses. And there are apparently a number of other states that are facing similar shortfalls. Again, does the federal government wind up being the bailout of last resort for that? And we're going to see this trickle-down effect to local governments where services are going to be cut back, and we're going to see this locally as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't think the federal government can really bail out the states. They may extend a loan. I mean, I think that's what Schwarzenegger is talking about. He might need to line up at the Fed discount window and say, hey, help us out with a loan. On favorable terms, but the government can't be bailing out the states, and it's far more likely that it will do what it did during the Reagan era, and which continued through the Clinton and the current Bush era, is to push services down to the state and local governments to try to get them off the Fed's books so that they can balance the federal budget. And there isn't going to be a lot of wiggle room at the state and local government levels to be able to pay for that kind of stuff. So at the very time that people are getting shoved out onto the street and shoved out of their jobs, there may be less and less in the way of a social safety net and public services to help them.
Is that Fed discount window, is that a drive-through, or do you have to walk in off the street?
No, you have to.
No, walking in off the street has been part of the problem, actually.
Yeah. You have to have walked in off of Wall Street in order to get
it's a drive-through on Wall Street. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else on that, or can we move on to international?
Drive-through or drive-by?
No, unless you guys have any questions that you think would be important economy-wise, we can move on.
I'm sure we'll have some more next week.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Moving on to international and developments in Pakistan.
The Red Cross has been pretty active in Pakistan, what with the ramping up war there. And the Red Cross finally said this week that Pakistan is now a war zone, that something we don't get in the media here in the U.S. is the report that the Pakistani government has opened up heavy fighting now and has opened up the war on three separate fronts. Not just in the Swat Valley where they've been fighting for months, and the Taliban still has mostly taken control of the valley and hasn't given it up. And where last week the Taliban, in order to prove that they control the Swat Valley, they just completely destroyed the power, the entire power grid that services the Swat Valley, just as a sign to show, look, we control this area and you don't. But They've opened up a front in Bajur and also just south of
93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
Which is a little bit nerve-wracking for the Pakistani people to know that the front against the Taliban is coming that close to a major city.
No. And we also saw, again this morning, another 20-plus people in Pakistan killed by a U.S. Missile attack. And that is once again going to heighten tensions between the U.S. and Pakistan, I think. And certainly the United States is not very popular among Pakistani people right now. And that, again, drives people into the arms of the Taliban and to be more sympathetic to the militants because they're the ones who are standing up to the Pakistani government in its alliance with the United States.
Well, yeah, and the United States has still to learn the lesson of, gee, if we want to fight a war, we kind of need some allies. And in this case, the Bush administration is doing very darn little to make an ally of the Pakistani government, which is what really needs to happen if you're going to show some kind of infrastructure improvements that lure people away from supporting the Taliban in these areas that are vastly impoverished, where the people do have a lot of support for anybody who's willing to fight a government that's exploited them rather than supported them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the highlights to me of the vice presidential debate this week was when Joe Biden said what we need in Pakistan is to build schools, and he's absolutely right.
And that's correct. Yes.
And it's something that's been PR efforts to the contrary flagrantly missing from the war efforts of the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Betcha.
Moving next door to Pakistan, India, developments there.
Yeah, actually it wasn't India, it was the U.S. Congress, but it was about India. We had this week the passage of a treaty celebrating the nuclear alliance between the United States and India. And just to remind folks, because we tend to have very short memories here in the U.S., 10 years ago, India was on a list of countries that were subject to economic sanctions by the United States because it had gone and tested and gotten nuclear weapons without going through the international framework for it. Both India and Pakistan did this. Now both countries are allies of the United States under the Bush administration, both been rewarded essentially for their nuclear programs, and now the United States, in a treaty that nearly brought down the Indian government, it was so controversial in India, has basically signed off on a package to heighten the nuclear arsenal of India at a very, very volatile part of the world, obviously, in flagrant contradiction to the international nuclear weapons control regime. So if Obama is elected in November and comes in, one of the things that's going to have to be negotiated almost immediately is a replacement for the current international nuclear arms control structure, which actually is set to expire in, I believe it's 2010, and the Bush administration has not had any serious negotiations around that at all, and treaties like this only undermine it further.
All right, talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a wonderful little community newspaper and website that has, you know, a local as well as national and international news and humor and opinion. Also online at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, anything like that, email is info@eatthestate.org.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
America is no more interested in preserving the Republic than they're interested in anything else other than profits. That's just the nature of corporate America. So, you know, they set this up, let them deal with it.
I think that it makes sense for us to present ourselves before the American people to talk about the nature of the problems that we're having in our financial system, to talk about how it relates to our global standing in the world, what implications it has for our national security, how it relates to critical questions like the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, obviously, if it turns out that we need to be in Washington, we've both got big planes. We've painted our slogans on the sides of them. They can get us from Washington, D.C. to Mississippi fairly quickly.
The last thing we need in these delicate negotiations is an injection. definition of presidential politics.
The party is over. The party is over for this compensation for CEOs who take the golden parachute as they drive their companies into the ground. The party is over for the disparity in our country between CEOs making almost immoral salaries. The party is over.
We need to be focused. Becoming more precarious by the day.
I think the choice.
But I think it is also important that the American
becoming more precarious by the day. I face the choice.
Moving the economy forward. I believe that we should consider
becoming more precarious by the day. I face the choice.
The party is over.
I'm a strong believer in free enterprise, so my natural instinct is to oppose government intervention. I believe companies that make bad decisions should be allowed to go out of business, but these are not normal circumstances. The market is not functioning properly. There's been a widespread loss of confidence, and major sectors of America's financial system are at risk of shutting down. Tonight, the government's top economic experts warn that without immediate action by Congress, America could slip into a financial panic. An interesting scenario would unfold. More banks could fail, including some in your community. Stock market would drop even more. The value of your home could plummet. Closures would rise dramatically. And if you own a business or a farm, you would find it harder and more expensive to get credit. More businesses would close their doors. The market is not functioning properly. The market is not functioning properly. The market is not functioning properly. Country could experience a long and painful recession. Citizens, we must not let this happen. I know that an economic rescue package will present a tough vote for many members of Congress. It is difficult to pass a bill that commits so much of the taxpayers' hard-earned money, pay the cost of excesses on Wall Street. Given the situation we are facing, not passing a bill now would cost these Americans much more. How would a rescue plan work? Including mortgage-backed securities, now clogging the financial system. This would free banks to resume the flow of credit to American families. The participation of financial institutions, large and small. It should make certain that failed executives do not receive a windfall from your tax dollars. Close consultation with Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, and SEC Chairman Chris Cox. The market is not functioning properly. The market is not functioning properly, protecting your money. Financial system. Banks to resume the flow of credit to American families. The market is not functioning properly. The market is not functioning properly. The market is not functioning properly.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for the week starting October 6th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. This week in radical history for October 7th.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In 1879, labor organizer Joe Hill is born. He'd be killed on this date by the state of Utah after a sham trial. He wired his labor organizers' friends these words: I'd like to die a true blue rebel. Don't waste any more time mourning. Organize. And his last words in front of the firing squad was, fire.
San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill.
And it is right here where you will find more radical history. Like on October 7th in 1909, letting all principals know what's up, the U.S. consulate reports a revolution against the Nicaraguan government will begin on October 8th. Also on this date in 1934 in Brazil, green shirt fascists in Sao Paulo attempt to mimic Mussolini's march on Rome, only to be scattered in disarray when confronted by the anarchists and farm workers, who unite in opposition to the fascists. Also on this date in 1969, the Haymarket statue, a memorial to cops slain who fired on workers in 1886 in Chicago, is bombed, reported to be bombed by the Weather Underground. The mayor rebuilds the statue, and it is bombed again next year. Learning his lesson, the mayor rebuilds it again and has to place a 24-hour guard around the statue. Also on this date in 1969, black football players at the University of Wyoming are kicked off the team for protesting against the Mormons of Utah State for segregation at Brigham Young University. Also on October 7, 1987, religious zealous and hypocrite Pat Robinson acknowledges to the Wall Street Journal report that he's been less than candid about his wedding date and his first child was born only 10 weeks after his marriage. He follows a long line before him and after him, like Family Values man Ronald Reagan, who married his second wife, Nancy, who had a baby 7 months after that, and hypocrite VP candidate Palin shotgun weddings. In your face, Christian Family Values. Two more items for October 7th, 1990. Justice Department reports U.S. prison population doubled in the last 10 years. Worst in the Western world. Yeah, we're number one. We're number one. Lastly, in 1993, Guatemala. A mass grave of 150 women and children murdered by the U.S.-supported and trained Guatemala army is opened. The U.S. government documents released in 1999 describes in chilling detail, often in cold bureaucratic language, how American advisors and their Cold War obsession spurred on the killing and hid the horrible secrets from the public. This Week in Radical History for October 8th, only got a couple items. 1871, Mrs. O'Leary's cow starts a Chicago fire in the evening, kills over 200 and over 98,000 left homeless, as 3.5 square miles of the city burn to the ground. As Chicago blazes away some 200 miles to the south, an even deadlier fire rips through Peshtigo, Wisconsin, completely razing to the town and killing 600 of its inhabitants. Over 1 million acres of forest was also consumed. Also for October 8, 1976, President Ford signs a bill to terminate Indian Claims Commission, ending any mechanism for repayment of land stolen from the tribes. In the year 2000, over 1,000 protesters gather to oppose Hong Kong's law prohibiting public demonstration by more than 30 people without permission of Officer Friendly. You know, why not do what freedom-loving, protecting United States does and give protesters free speech zones, nice pinned-in areas to express themselves? Also in the year 2000, that date, hey Saddam, beat this. American government releases documents showing it tested chemical and biological weapons in the open air in Alaska, Hawaii, Alberta, Canada, and Great Britain. We're number one. We're number one. This Week in Radical History for October 9th. Breaking the myth once again that America was founded on religious freedoms, in 1635, Roger Williams, a member of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, an outspoken critic of the ill-treatment of Native Americans, is banished from the colonies for, quote, religious heresy, unquote.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 9th, in 1823, black American abolitionist and newspaper publisher Mary Ann Shad Carey was born in Wilmington, Delaware. When Mary was 17 years old, she opened a school for black children in Pennsylvania. 10 years later, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and Mary moved to Canada, where she founded a racially integrated school, as well as establishing the Provincial Freeman, a newspaper that attacked slavery and promoted the education of blacks. After moving back to the U.S., Mary graduated from Howard Law School, becoming the second black woman in the U.S. to graduate with a law degree. During her career as a lawyer, Mary Ann Shad worked hard to achieve voting rights for women in America. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date in 1936, during a lettuce strike in Salinas, California, red flags appeared around town, specifically at intersections and power poles. Fearing communists, the local authorities took down the flags, only to discover later that they were part of a traffic check being made by the State Highway Division. Oops. Also on this date in 1969, 2,500 National Guard called into Chicago, Illinois, for the 9th through the 11th during the Weather Underground Days of Rage protest. For a great movie on the Weather Underground, to see a pretty reasonable evolution and delusion of political uprising in this country, see the Academy Award-nominated movie from 2 years ago, also called Weather Underground. Also on October 9, 1970 in England, the Italian Trade Center, Exhibition Building, Cork Street, London is bombed. Attacks simultaneously happened in Manchester, Birmingham, Paris, and against Italian state buildings. The attacks were claimed on behalf of an Italian anarchist murdered by the police in 1969, part of a large series of bombings for this year believed to be attributed to the Anarchist Angry Brigade. Two more items were October 9, 1983. James Watts resigns as Reagan's Secretary of the Interior after referring to his appointment of a black, a woman, two Jews, and a cripple. Earlier in this week, one of Reagan's aides also pleads guilty to the involvement in the weapons for hostage trade Iran-Contra scandal.
We talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, delivered by hand. Nobody move, or the CEO gets it in the face with cream and dough. See them scramble
to the top. Lastly, for October 9, 1998, neoliberal economist Milton Friedman gets just desserts at the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco during the School Choice and Corporate America Conference. The Triple B field agents, custard and lemon meringue, approached him and let fly with tofu cream and sweet potato pies. Just desserts, delivered by hand. This week in Radical History for October 10th, 1609 in England. Gerard Winstanley, founder of the Diggers, is born. The Diggers attempted to reform by leveling real property, the existing social order of the time, with an agrarian lifestyle based upon their ideas of the creation of a small, egalitarian rural communities. Their use of public lands in England enraged the local manor owners and townspeople, and the government would eventually put them all down. Here's a song about the Diggers written by Winstanley at the time, sung by the anarchist group Chumbawamba.
Stand up now, you noble diggers, all stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes, stand up now. The clergy they come in, stand up now, the clergy they come in, stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win, stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round, stand up now, the gentry are all round, stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground, stand up now. The club is all their law, stand up now, the club is all their law, stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, that they no vision saw, to maintain such a law, stand up now, diggers all.
A couple more items for October 10th, 1954 in Guatemala. CIA-sponsored Colonel Carlos Armas becomes president, via democracy, America style. Also 1960, Irish poet and playwright Brendan Meehan appears on Jack Parr's show and famously says, "I've never seen a situation so dismal that the police can't make it worse." Also, the Diggers are back in the news, only this time 350 years later in 1966, when the modern-day version of the Diggers, founded in San Francisco, start distributing free food at the Golden Gate Park. Lastly, 1990, reparation payments begin to survivors and families of the Japanese Americans taken from their homes and put into concentration camps during World War II. In the entire course of the war, 10 people would be convicted of spying for Japan, all of whom are Caucasians. That's score again, folks. Caucasians 10, Asians 0. This week in Radical History for October 11th, 1910, Nicaragua. Three generals and U.S. company officials form a governing junta to protect the American interests. Also on that date in 1958, the second attempt to send a rocket around the moon fails when its excessively high trajectory causes it to fall back to Earth. The U.S. space program, however, will improve under von Braun and his 126 Nazis whisked away for us. Most of the Rocketeers were dedicated German Nazis whisked out of Europe to continue the work for us here in the United States. At the time of their surrender, they were working on a rocket to deliver warheads to New York City, as they had done to London with the V-2. Under Operation Paperclip, these war criminals were slipped away to the United States, kept under wraps, and referred to themselves as POPs, Prisoners of Peace, at Fort Bliss, Texas.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 11th in 1972, a group of Chicano teachers, students, and community activists in Seattle, Washington, entered the abandoned Beacon Hill High School building and announced their intention to stay until the city met their demands. The group peacefully occupied the school for 3 months in the middle of winter before they were finally granted the space to establish a Chicano community center. This action was triggered after the city abruptly cut funding for an adult basic education and ESL program at the local community college, leaving its students ripped of their educational resources. The community center, El Centro de la Raza, became one of the most effective Latino civil rights organizations in America. Now that's community empowerment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for October 11th, 1987, up to 750,000 gays, lesbians, and bisexuals and their supporters marched for civil rights in Washington. This is the second lesbian and gay march, and again generally goes underreported by the press. Now each year at this time it is celebrated as the National Coming Out Day. This week in Radical History for October 12th, 1492 in the New World, Columbus. Invader, slaver, thief, murderer, liar, madman, he and his crew signals the start of the European invasion of the Americas. We could subjugate them all, unquote. Columbus wrote at the start of the European destruction of the American continent, there is no holiday for the tribes of the Arawaks, who lived there at the time that Columbus discovered them. In the next 25 years, all 50,000 natives had died or been shipped away as slaves. Also on October 10, 1896, Johann Most, German-American anarchist, and Emma Goldman's former mentor, denounces her at the time in the event of the New York, where she was soliciting funds for the commemoration of the execution of the Haymarket martyrs. Emma would seek him out, find him on stage, and punch him in the face.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 12th in 1898, the Verdun Massacre occurred when a labor conflict between the Chicago Verdun Coal Company and their unionized miners in St. Louis turned violent. The tension began after the Verdun Company backed down on their promise to enforce an 8-hour workday and a pay increase. The company then brought in hundreds of non-unionized black laborers from Alabama and locked the union workers out of the mines. As a train carrying the strike breakers arrived, shots were fired between the strikers and the armed guards, resulting in the death of many union members and a few guards. The Verdun Company then left the black laborers stranded in St. Louis with no money or shelter and gave in to the mining union's terms. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date, 1925 in Panama, 600 U.S. Marines land and take over police duties in Panama City during the strike and rent riots to, okay, all together now, say it with me, to protect the American interests. Also in 1950, the American Legion Conventions calls for the concentration camps for all U.S. communists and the atom bombing of the Soviet Union. Yeah, right, you guys first, okay? Also in 1970, Lieutenant William Calley court-martialed for the massacre of 102 civilians at My Lai during the Vietnam War. He will get his wrist slaps with 1 year of house arrest and is considered by many in the right wing to be a war hero. By the way, the original investigating officer who started the My Lai massacre cover-up, that would be then First Lieutenant Colin Powell. Also on that date in 1971 in Cuba, the CIA sponsored terrorist attacks at Boca de Sama, machine-gunning the village, killing two and injuring four, one of the four, a 15-year-old girl who lost her legs in a result of gunshot wounds. God bless America. The White House Press Secretary Ronald Reagan's mouthpiece, Larry Speaks, tells the press pool in this date in 1982, quote, "You don't tell us how to stage the news, and we won't tell you how to report it," unquote. Humiliated by Bush aides describing their job as having to potty train him, VP Dan Quayle declares independence from his handlers. Quote, "Look it," he says, "I've done it their way this far, and now it's my turn. I'm my own handler. Any questions? Ask me. There's not going to be any more handler stories because I'm the handler. I'm the Dr. Spin," unquote. Deja vu all over again.
But her job is also to deal interagency and to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. And unstick them. And is she listening? Doing a fine job.
That's why I say I, like every American I'm speaking with, we're ill about this position that we have been put in, where it is the taxpayers looking to bail out. But ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, helping the... Oh, it's got to be all about jobs.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. There are some who... I feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on. If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Creation to shoring up our economy and putting it back on the right track. So health care reform and reducing taxes and reining in spending has got to accompany tax reductions and tax relief for Americans. And trade, we've got to see trade as opportunity, not as a competitive, scary thing, but 1 in 5 jobs being created in the trade sector today. We've got to look at that as more opportunity. All those things under the umbrella of job creation, this bailout is a part of that.
It's doing a fine job. And to help unstick things that may get stuck. That's what it says. It's an unsticker. It's an unsticker.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Hope you've enjoyed this week's show. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, remember Joe Hill and I, Mike Cannon, are always and forever yours in the struggle.
I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.